Hi, today's March 26, 2016. This is Mobile News Podcast number 155. I'm Todd Ogasso Ward, my good friend John Westfall. And today, we are joined by my other good friend, Don Watkins, who I have not spoken to in, we think, 16 or 17 years. I mean, it's not that we're fighting. We just have not met up face-to-face in all that time. And this year, you know, for years, I've been wanting to get Don on a podcast. And for one reason or another, it didn't happen, but mostly me. But this year is special. 2016 is a big anniversary year for technology. Apple turns 40 years old on April 1st. It was incorporated in 1977, for those of you who are purists, but they, you know, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak actually formed a company on April 1st, 1976, and the IBM PC turns 35 years old in August. And both of these were, you know, really life-changing for me, I'm sure for Don, and I would say it was society-changing. It changed the way we do things, the way we think, and then, of course, once the internet kicked in, it, you know, nothing was ever the same again. So, hello, Don.
Hey there. Hey there, Todd.
Welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And I just wanted to get through some real quick, two quick items, I guess, before we speak the rest of the time with Don. And one is the latest article I published in Extreme Tech is titled, provocatively, "Could the 9.7-inch iPad Pro kickstart a tablet upgrade cycle?" A lot of people say no, it won't, by the way. But I think that it won't cause people who bought a tablet in the last year or two to buy it. People like me who haven't bought an full-size iPad since 2011, that would be 5 years ago, I'll look at it and go, so it only has 2 gigs versus 4 gigs of RAM. My iPad 2 has like half a gig, so it's a big upgrade for me. A couple of items since I published the article that were learned. One, it turns out that the A9X was clocked down compared to the big iPad Pro. And as I mentioned, it only has 2 gigs of RAM versus 4 on the big one. And when I looked to order it, and I haven't ordered it yet, I'm going to order it soon. But when I looked to order it, the Smart Keyboard was not available for pre-order. The other funny thing that some people notice is that the Microsoft Office Office 365 is listed as an option right in the pre-order page for the new 9.7-inch iPad Pro. And one other thing. It has an embedded Apple SIM if you get the LTE version, not the Wi-Fi version, of course, which means except for Verizon, I think you can use any cell provider's LTE data stuff without putting a SIM. And I think Verizon forces you to use their SIM, and if you use AT&T, they lock you down so you can't use anybody else. So go check the various articles about that one. I did not do the detailed report on the embedded Apple SIM. Last news item before we get to Don is Google, which bought the Nik collection of Photoshop and Aperture filters about a couple of years ago, made the and lowered the price to $150. I think it was way more than that before. It's now free. And even if you don't have Photoshop or Aperture, you can still use it if you grab the open source GIMP photo editor that's available for PCs and Macs. I've not tried it in Mac yet. And I got it to work on one PC. Actually, I got it to work on my Asus Windows 10 tablet, but I couldn't get it to work on my Dell Windows 10 notebook. So, not sure what the problem is there, except one is running a 32-bit Windows 10, the other is a 64-bit Windows 10, but that doesn't seem like it should be a problem. Any case, those are the two news items, and I wanted to welcome Don again. Don, for some of us, Don is like a legend, you know. Well, not like a legend, he's a legend. I met him when I was a contractor, and he was also a contractor for the Microsoft Network at its launch in 1995. I don't know, Don, you may have come aboard. You probably came aboard earlier than me.
And no, about 95.
And but before that, even more importantly, he was the founder of the IBM Users Network on CompuServe, and I think others. Right, you ran like 4 or 5 groups. Forum groups on CompuServe?
Yeah, there were seven. The CompuServe hardware platform was fairly limited. Owned, I think, basically a homebrew PDP-8 computer. And so we had 7 forums: applications, hardware, new users, communications, utilities, programming, and PC Junior.
PC Junior. I've heard that in a long
time. PC Junior. Talk about a blast from the past.
Yeah. Yeah. So this all started in 1982. Reading your bio, and you know, for those of you who don't know what it was like in 1982, like our friend John Westfall here is too young to remember that. This was a wild and woolly days. There was an internet only if you were on the MILNET in the military, or if you were on their ARPANET side on a research institute or university. The rest of us had 300 baud modems. This is how we communicated, if you were lucky, and they were expensive. And you know, there are some people are putting up bulletin boards in their homes, but you'd get a busy signal because they only had one line or something. So it was a big deal when Don created this user group on CompuServe that, well, not unlimited number of phone lines, but so many that it really didn't matter for the most people. I don't think anybody ever hit a busy signal trying to get into CompuServe.
Very true.
And so Don, tell us about it. You know, I never really had a chance to talk to you about it when we were at MSN. So what was your first PC like? What made you buy it? And then let's go from there.
I had been in mainframe data processing before it evolved into really exotic names like management information or information technology, doing the bread and butter banking applications like checking accounts and auto loans and things like that. And we had tried Apple IIs for some departments that needed specialized financial software. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, people were using handheld calculators and, TIs, programmable calculators. And when the IBM came along, one, we were IBM customers. We were an IBM shop. So it made it very easy to buy a PC. But mostly, the PC really, people forget that, in my opinion, the Apple II really didn't have good video for doing detailed financial work. You could pretty much go blind looking at an Apple II monitor for 8 hours a day.
Yeah.
And the PC had a very good keyboard for people who were used to using a Selectric typewriter. So it really became the first business machine that we could deploy and felt comfortable in doing so.
You know,
and
I
was right there. Yeah, I was right there with them. My first machine was a 64K with a single floppy and a graphics adapter, so I could hook it up to the monitor I had been using on my Apple II, just to keep my
sound. You know, I never thought of it that way. You know, for those people who don't remember, the Apple II, and I had an Apple II also, had a 40-character long display, or 40 characters across, and I don't think it was 24 down. It was like maybe 16 down.
It was limited.
Yeah. So imagine looking at, using today, we don't really count characters across the screen. We count pixels today. But imagine looking at a window probably about 2 inches across and maybe 1 inch down on your current day monitor. And that was the display that was available to most people on an Apple II in relatively what you could see. Now, of course, our displays weren't physically that small, but you were looking at you're like looking at a keyhole if you're looking at a VisiCalc spreadsheet or something.
Oh yeah, and VisiCalc was the killer app at the time.
Yeah, and I never thought about the keyboard. You're right. You know, IBM, famous for its Selectric keyboard, brought a great clicky keyboard. Which no other anybody does anymore, but great.
And
clicky
keyboard. I still have a cache of clicky keyboards. I've got like 8 of them. I cannot use the soft keyboards that people put out these days.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that, how even today there are people who are my age that didn't grow up with really knowing Selectric typewriters, but there are still people that love clicky keyboard versus the softer keyboard. So it's something that even today we're still kind of talking about what keyboard style is most comfortable for most people.
Yeah, and these fans of that kind of keyboard are willing to pay $200 for keyboard when you can get the conventional soft keyboard for probably what, 20, 30 bucks these days?
Yeah.
Free.
Yep.
As a matter of fact, unsolicited piece here, but I think it's clickykeyboard.com.
Oh.
If you want to go there, it's a hoot.
It's literally
because they
that.
sell Yeah, they refer bull keyboards and they sell a billion of them.
I have to go look at that. I'm typing that down now on my soft keyboard.
But at least we can't hear you do it.
Yeah, I'll admit I love clicky keyboards, but I've never gotten addicted to them. So mine are all just the softer keyboards as well. But
yeah. You know,
even my generation, people love those things.
Right, and to support what Don was saying about the display, so the IBM monochrome, and, you know, you had to buy separate adapters for the IBM if you wanted a monochrome display for nice text and, you know, VisiCalc and stuff, or if you wanted graphics. And I bought both of the display cards. So the monochrome display had 80 characters across and 25 characters down, and you had to buy a special monochrome monitor for it, which is kind of expensive. I know I had to borrow money from my parents. Actually, I didn't borrow it. They gave me the money to buy that stuff. But it had a beautiful display. You know, it was a green, like I said, a green screen display. So what most of us were used to using traditional keyboards, while the CGA, and I'm not saying this wrong, folks. It's not VGA. CGA was color graphics adapter. I think it was 320 pixels by 200 pixels by an amazing 16 colors. So basically, it's like if your screen looked at that today, you'd say, hey, what's wrong with this thing? But yeah, it was a huge difference from what we see today.
And the monochrome display was sharp. It was just remarkable. And even if you went outside of IBM and went with an Amdek 310, their Amber monitor, it was just as good. And it made a huge difference to people who were working with numbers 8 hours a day.
Yeah, yeah. Especially if they went from an Apple II with, 40 characters across to basically a real display, what they were used to.
Absolutely.
And I think also the refresh rate was really different. So as you were scrolling down a spreadsheet, you didn't get sort of visual persistence effect you were getting in color monitors. So it's much easier in the eyes in multiple ways than the color displays of the time. Many of which are just regular TVs with composite inputs.
Through an RCA jack.
Yeah.
Oh.
Not exactly optimal.
You know, as you guys are talking about this, one of the things that strikes me is I am really happy that I grew up in a time where, I was born in 1982, so I was not on the internet at that point, but I came on the internet around 95, 96, and I remember, that hardware you're talking about was still around. You'd still see it in, people's garages.
Oh, yeah.
And friends of mine had it. And when I think about that and I talk with people who are younger than me, my students in my classes and things like that, they have really no appreciation for the monumental leaps and bounds that happened in computing hardware between 1980 and 2000.
Yeah.
Because they see a computer from 2000 today, if they have a friend or a family member who still has one, and you take something from 2000 to now, and you notice that the resolution's not as high and the graphics aren't as good, but it doesn't look as big a jump from that 15-year period than the previous 15 before that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Another comparison for folks to think about, my IBM PC, which I bought in 1982 when it was released. I think I bought a big 64 kilobyte model. I think that default base model was 16 KB. I don't know if Don, if you remember.
Yeah, it was 16.
16, yeah. So, people looked at me and said, wow, you're getting 64K? What do you need that for?
What are you going to do with all that memory, Matt?
Yeah. And of course, Bill Gates famously said, nobody needs more than 512 kilobytes.
Right? I remember when my dad bought his first computer and the first computer for our family, it was, I guess, 1988, 89, and he wanted 4 megabytes of RAM.
That was
unheard of. The shop told him he was nuts.
Yeah.
Why would you want that? There's no reason for it. Even, he was using it for laying out text and advertising layouts and things like that. And 105 megabyte hard drive and 4 megs of RAM. Why would you need anything more?
Yeah, well, again, this is a little bit further on, but in 1996 or so, when I was still working for GTE, I remember going to the first internal internet conference up in Waltham, Massachusetts. And one of the things I wanted to talk to people about, because I wasn't involved in the project, but I wanted to learn from them, is there's the GT Government Systems, who I think were doing the Agent Orange database for the government. And the way they got the speed up was they kept all the entire database in RAM. And they had 4 gigabytes of RAM in 1996, which was unheard of back then. You know, most of us had maybe a gig, maybe a couple of gigs of RAM. But they had 4 gigs of RAM. They kept the entire relational database in there back then. So amazing changes in the last, 35 years.
Yeah, Moore's Law applies to more than CPUs.
Absolutely.
All technology has just, it's amazed me. Back then, I really look back on it, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times.
It was MS-DOS.
So, yeah.
Or PC-DOS if you had an IBM, I guess. Yeah, and floppies, you mentioned that I sprung for dual floppies because, as I said, I got money from my parents.
I think my first floppy drive was 160 KB.
Yeah, the single density.
The single density.
Yes, yeah,
and
single density.
That was ugly, but it was better than a tape drive.
Right. And then later, we all bought those square hole punches so we could punch a notch out in the floppy so we could use both sides. Remember that?
Oh, absolutely.
You had to be really careful because if you notched it incorrectly, the pieces would shatter inwards and you'd ruin your disks. And I think a pack of 10 floppy disks, I remember paying $40. I think
you got a good deal.
And when you think about it, that's for, if you double-sided, double density, you're talking 3.6 megabytes of data for $40. So, good times.
Yeah, worst of times.
So you got your IBM PC, and obviously you're really excited by it. Excited enough that you somehow wanted to talk to other people about it. And what happened next? How did you get involved with CompuServe, and how did all that happen?
Well, I couldn't afford a Hayes modem at the time because they were the Cadillacs.
Yeah.
And I remember I got a Novation DCAT, which was not smart. You had to dial up on a regular telephone. It wasn't an acoustic coupler, mm-hmm. but you did have to do all the dialing through a telephone. Mm-hmm. And then once you got the carrier, you had to mash a button that would then connect to your computer. And I connected to some bulletin boards, but it was so frustrating because as a single line system, it was typically busy,
right.
And you might have to dial 100, 120 times, and doing that manually was no fun. You couldn't even get, because it wasn't a smart modem, you had to do it manually. So I found a CompuServe starter kit at Radio Shack for the TRS-80. It was what they called a universal kit, and I connected the first dial, and I was amazed. I said, okay, here is the killer app for the PC. Because here was a host of other people who had computers who had probably solved half the problems I was having, along with anything else that I wanted to know, weather, news, and I was hooked. I was hooked instantly.
So you started.
That was it.
How did you contact CompuServe to start the forums and things?
They had a fella coming into town. Oh, pardon me. Let me go back. I was still working at the bank, and I don't know how this came about, but they contacted me asking me about online banking applications. I just don't have a memory of how that connection took place. But we got to talking, and one thing led to another. And they said, would you be interested in doing something for the PC on CompuServe?
Wow.
And I said, sign me up.
Wow. So they approached you. That I didn't know that part.
Yeah, it was like I said, I would have beat on their door to do it. But we were talking about online banking stuff, and perhaps I'd contacted them about that because I was working for a fairly innovative bank. We had had ATMs for a decade probably by that time, and I thought, how nice to have an online banking application. But again, this was in 1982, and 8 people had computers.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, it was probably a little bit ahead of its time. And now, of course, we accept it as something that is essential. You wouldn't use a bank that didn't have online banking. But back then, it was pretty cutting edge. And I couldn't turn down the opportunity to do something in the online world.
So were you working for the bank and doing stuff for CompuServe, or were you able to switch over to CompuServe at this point?
Initially, I probably continued working at the bank for about 2 or 3 months.
Wow.
But I was pretty much full in on the online thing. And even though I thought I had a fairly good career at the bank, I was all in on the online world.
Wow. I didn't realize you had switched that fast.
Oh, yeah. It was suicide, but I was willing to take that risk.
Wow, that is amazing. I mean, that's pretty much the dream of many people today, right? To be able to do what they love online and, you know, not have to make that, you know, what I do every day and, you know, make that drive into work through rush hour and all of that.
Yeah, I went from an hour commute to a 5-minute commute. I loved it.
Yeah, yeah. Earlier you said you ran 7 forum groups, all of which were IBM PC related. So they're just subcategories within the IBM PC, including the PC Junior, which I'd completely forgotten about.
For good reason.
And so what were your influences in career? I mean, there was no, can I say that? I mean, there was Usenet, but unless you were an ARPANET Milnet, you didn't have access to Usenet back then. Were there other user groups on CompuServe when you started with them in 82?
Oh, yeah. TRS, COCO, Color Computer, Atari. So, you know, the template was there. Other people had gone before, for sure. And it was just the fact that the IBM and clones got so big that it kind of took on a life of its own.
Yeah, but it's still very early on. I mean, in 82, I was still mostly, mostly bulletin boards, and I think I had gotten dial-up access to Usenet through a friend who had gotten a become a Usenet node, and was grabbing the newsfeed through that over probably, I think he had sprung for a 1200 baud modem, so he was, you know, really ahead of the curve. But it was very early days. You know, I was still going to in-person user groups at the time. But I don't know. How did the user groups influence you? I know that we really don't see them in much anymore.
Yeah, good point. I guess because computers have gotten a lot easier. Mm-hmm. So we don't need each other quite so much as we used to. Plus, back then, if you were into computers, you were kind of, I guess, what you'd call a hobbyist. And it was something that you really enjoyed getting into. And I think people use them more as tools these days rather than something else.
Yeah, what I tell people, my memory of the days, some of the big differences are many of the people you would run into who were hobbyists could safely pick up a soldering iron and do something useful. And many people could code, whether it was an assembler or in BASIC or something. And basically, there weren't many other somethings around. It was very expensive to get something like Fortran or COBOL on a microcomputer, as we called it back then. But people could do stuff with hardware. I mean, I remember having to grab discrete integrated circuits to fix my floppy drive every time it blew out. It was kind of the Model T days of computing, where you had to know how to fix stuff.
Very true. I remember you had to do ramectomies. You had to change RAM chips on your motherboard.
That's right. Yeah, you had to buy a special tool to extract them, and then even more special tool to put them in, and so you don't bend the little legs on it. They look.
Yeah, you were guaranteed to bend a leg.
We used to have at the university I was at the time. We used to have, I forget what it called, RAM Fest or something like that, for people who are less facile with their fingers. We would, you know, we'd have hundreds of people come in with their little plastic tubes of RAM, which is how RAM was shipped back then. They look like magic wands today, I guess. And we'd help them, you know, open up their computer and put in their RAM and send them happily off back home. It was quite the thing. I wish we had photos of it. Most people probably would not believe it.
It was pretty amazing.
I was wondering. You know, I know you're in. You're also notable for your work at Shareware, and we should. And I guess I should define what Shareware is before I ask you more about it. So, back in the days of yore, this is 1970s, 1980s. Most commercial software, like the stuff from Microsoft, came in little Ziploc plastic bags. Was Ziploc there on there? It was something that looked like Ziploc anyway. Very few had actual packaging. I think Microsoft may have had packaging, but they still came in plastic bags. And other people were trying a different model where they would let you, usually not download because nobody had enough connectivity to download software, but eventually it would turn into places that CompuServe had directories of software you could download. Or you would more likely go to a user group meeting where floppies or something would be distributed and you could try out the software. And if you liked it, and it was pretty much an honor system, I think, you would send money into these folks as a way of saying, hey, I'm using your software and it's worth something to me. And, here's the money you're asking for. It was some $10, $35, usually not much more than that. So how did you get involved with Shareware? Was it through CompuServe?
Through my local user group and through CompuServe and bulletin boards. And, my first exposure to it was in 82, was Andrew Flugelman's PC Talk.
Oh, yeah.
Was, as far as I know, the first try before you buy on the honor system type software. And an excellent communications program for the time.
Yeah.
Jim Button was out about the same time. And then Bob Wallace came out with, I think he called his actually Shareware. I think Flugelman called his freeware, which was weird because it wasn't free. Jim Button called his user-supported software, and Bob Wallace called his Shareware. And Bob, by the way, he's the guy that wrote the Pascal compiler for Microsoft and was one of the original Microsoft founders.
Really?
Yeah, one of the original seven. Very interesting fella, by the way. And so I got very involved with it simply because, a lot of times it was better than commercial software. I mean, there were exceptions, but and there was a huge variety, more so than your local computer world could carry. And then in, I think, around 85, a fellow by the name of Nelson Ford, who was founder of the either a founder or a founding member of the Houston PC user group, had a service called Public Software Library. He was a driving force in establishing the Association of Shareware Professionals. And they really came up with some real standards in terms of what is shareware. And one of the problems, of course, was on one end of the spectrum, you could have fully functioning software. Right. And on the other end, you could have basically a PowerPoint presentation of what the software did. Mm. And if you were, dialing in long distance or you were paying connection fees and you downloaded a demo, you were pretty upset.
Yeah.
So the ASP really developed some standards. So if you saw it was from a member of the ASP, you pretty much knew what you were getting. You weren't getting crippled stuff that you really couldn't get a fair run at. And it became for many years, it became a fairly good way for small software authors to distribute software. And to this day, if you think about it, nowadays you can try Microsoft Office or whatever for a period of time before you have to buy it.
Yeah, there is a trial period, right.
Same with Windows 10, for goodness sake. So really kind of Shareware kind of moved the commercial market to where we are today.
Yeah, I agree. And in fact, even in the mobile space where you have these freemium apps, which are free to use, generally are mostly full function or close to full function. But if you want additional features or you want to get rid of the advertisements, you pay $3 or $4, sometimes more, to get whatever it is you want, whether it's be ad-free or more features, or both usually. So that's kind of where I think shareware has evolved into.
Yeah, absolutely. And with shareware, you know, you paid money sometimes to get rid of a nag screen.
Yeah.
So very similar to what you mentioned.
And, you know, speaking, you just mentioned that people would dial in long distance sometimes to download something or go online. My recollection of CompuServe, and I probably didn't have a CompuServe account until about 88 or 89, but my recollection is they charged by the minute after some, you know, they had like some, the first 20 minutes of the month are free or something. But you can correct me on that. And they charged different amounts depending on what speed modem you came in. So they charged less if you're using a 1200 baud modem and more if you're lucky enough to have a 24 or 9600 baud modem. Is that what you remember, Don?
That's correct. And my memory is really fuzzy other than the fact it was really expensive.
Yeah.
We're talking 10, 12 bucks an hour.
Yeah.
You know, which added up, you know,
sure
very quickly
did.
if you spent a lot of time in chat.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was not cheap.
No, in fact,
but cheaper than long distance.
Absolutely. And I remember buying software. I can't remember if it was from a third party or from CompuServe itself, but it would do things like it would dial in for you, grab all your user group news items that you're interested, download software if you tell it what to do, and then log off. So you could you know, control or have better control over amount of time you're doing, you know, rather than spending 5 minutes reading an article. And in the meantime, you know, dollars are ticking away.
As a matter of fact, that was we had a program. It was the first automated program for the PC. It was called AutoSig, and SIGs were special interest groups or the forums on CompuServe. Mm-hmm. And a fella by the name of Vern Burke, who was just a brilliant programmer. Back in the DOS days, you might have known him from his program List. Was just a, you know, should have come with DOS. He wrote a program called AutoSig, and a couple of other people, including myself, did some coding along with it. And that's exactly what that program did. You told it what you wanted it to do. It went online, did it. Went offline. You composed your messages offline, and then it went back online and uploaded your replies and things like that. So, yeah, there were lots of ways you could cut the cost down, but it still wasn't cheap.
No, it wasn't. And but it was, you know, for those of us who didn't have access to the internet or had limited access, I think I was in graduate school by then, and I had Usenet access. I don't think we had actual access to anything else. And this is pre-web anyway. So this is before the Mosaic web browser and all that. So the internet was not quite the internet that people think of today. It was basically FTP file sharing sites and that sort of thing. Weren't you involved in one of those, not Simtel maybe, but one of those kind of sites?
I actually went to work for Simtel.
Oh, you did?
Later on. Yeah, it was much later on though, post FTP days.
Okay.
So after the web.
Yeah, in fact, I used to have a monthly subscription to the Simtel CDs, so I didn't have to download them. So every month I would get a set of CDs from Simtel with their latest freeware and shareware and whatever else they had on there. You know, a lot of it was text also, so a lot of the RFCs were on there that I could, you know, for reference. Again, this is pre-web, so this was a big deal to be able to get, you know, megabytes of data without having to pay a whole lot. You know, I think I paid, I don't know, $10 a month or something, $5 a month.
Yeah, back in the Walnut Creek CD days, I guess.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I couldn't remember who the publisher was. But yeah, Walnut Creek CD. Yeah, they had a whole bunch. I mean, it wasn't just Simtel. They had a whole bunch of CDs of stuff they collected, not just shareware, that you could purchase on a subscription basis or one-time basis. And I thought it was great. Because, as I said, you know, we had to pay by the minute back. And even when we got access to dial-up internet access, you know, we had a local ISP here that I can't remember how we paid, if it was flat fee or if it was time-based or whatever, but I remember thinking it was more than I really wanted to pay.
It was.
Even though I did. So tell us more about your the forums, the special interest groups you ran on CompuServe. So how did people interact by then? Did you have any special problems you had to deal with? I know when we were at Microsoft Network, I remember being kind of startled by, I think somebody during one of the orientation meetings before the launch saying, you know, if you get a suicidal call, you need to do this. And I said, whoa, I didn't even think of that. You know, those kind of things.
You know, it's amazing how, you know, how time passes and nothing changes. You know, we had the same problems we have today. Flamers, trolls, people, vendors coming in, disguising themselves as users, reviewing their own products. You know, we didn't have much experience to go by, but we pretty much figured out, you know, what to do as we went along. And, you know, it's pretty much the same as it is today. People don't change. The technology changes, but people don't change.
I'm actually a little surprised by that part because, you know, back then, everybody presumably had to be identified by credit card or something. So there was no true anonymity, right? I mean, CompuServe knew who you were, where you lived, and where your bank was.
That's true, but CompuServe had a firewall between the forums and their billing system.
Ah.
So you could go into a forum and say, my name is Joe Smith.
Right.
And, you know, maybe you were somebody totally different. So, yeah, you could, and people would get, again, these introduction kits from Radio Shack and sign up, and they could have 6-7 accounts and go in and have a conversation with themselves saying, boy, you know, this turkey modem is the best thing that I've ever seen. Everybody needs to go buy one. So not unlike vendors doing product reviews of their own products today.
Interesting. And did you know how many forum or SIG members you had back then?
Did. And typically, some of the bigger forums, we would have 30, 35,000 people. We would turn 2,000 to 3,000 messages a day.
Wow.
So, yeah, it was at the time, and not a lot for, you know, some places today, but back then it was really the place to be.
Wow, and that is a big number back then. Where, you know, that's probably an entire population of PC users in the U.S. I mean, that was a lot of people online, with both a PC or some other computer and a modem, which was not a normal thing to own back then. Because as you said, there were hundreds of dollars for a modem. I think I paid. I eventually got tired of dialing up at 300, and I saved up my nickels and dimes. I think I paid $300 or $400 for Hayes 1200 modem.
I know when the Hayes first came out, up until that time, it had traditionally been $100 for each baud. So a 300 baud modem was $300.
Yeah.
When the Smart Modem 1200 came out, it was $700. Was the list price. I think I got mine for $600.
I must have bought it later than you, because I don't think I paid – well, I couldn't have afforded to pay that much, to be honest. But, yeah, it was a lot of money when $600 could buy a lot more than it does today.
Well, that was –
I mean, just imagine – yeah, I was going to say, just imagine if that $100 a baud had still gone on and had come down. You know, a 56K modem, you would have had to take out a second mortgage for. So that's interesting to think about how manufacturers at one point were making a nice premium. Of course, the cost of production comes down as well. But really, it wasn't until you slash things so much that you're able to get the critical mass to kind of turn the internet into what it is today. So that's one situation where I'm glad industry gave up on one of the ways they were making money and admitted, okay, we can do it for less, so let's sell it for less.
Well, yeah, there were a lot of changes because, you know, because modems, analog modems that went up to, I think it maxed out, as you said, 56K, really was the Pony Express. It was a technology doomed to be, doomed to disappear, basically, to be obsoleted. Because as soon as cable modems and DSL became reasonably priced and were much, much orders of magnitude faster, people started abandoning the analog modems to the point where today very few dial-up things that you can find, and even fewer modems. You don't see any PCs or notebooks or tablets and modems on them these days.
Yeah, I can't remember the last time I saw a modem. I really can't.
Yeah. So it's really interesting how it came, and Hayes, as you said, was huge, a huge company. It was the Cadillac of modems and U.S. robotics, and they're all gone now. I don't know if they got morphed into something or probably absorbed into something, but they're certainly not around that I can see.
Yeah, Zywell, I believe, makes routers, but they're the only modem company from back in those days that is still in business that I know of.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting that they didn't, you know, morph into... Well, it was hard to, I guess, because the cable modems really came from big industry, and DSLs kind of flattened anyway, and we haven't really seen much in DSL development in years now, though there's still a lot of DSL customers, of course. But basically, its service hasn't changed in probably a decade.
Well, you'll be happy to know you can get a US Robotics 56K modem over USB for $16.99 on Amazon.
Wow.
So there, you can still buy them. Although it's interesting because the supported software, you would have to go find an old computer to basically use it, because I don't think macOS supports modems anymore. I don't think even Windows 10 might support modems anymore.
That's an interesting point. And this is Back to the Future, right? So when I got my first Hayes smart modem, which was 300 baud, I did spring for that one, Don. I plugged into my TRS-80 Model 1 and realized I had no software to actually use it. So, and I was, of course, too cheap. I had spent all my money buying the modem, so I had to break out my Z80 assembler, and I had to write a terminal program in assembler over the weekend.
Oh, I am impressed. Oh, man.
But it was probably the world's crappiest, pardon my language, terminal. But it worked well enough to log in to, you know, local bulletin boards and things. So it was good enough.
Don, you can't imagine being Todd's daughter. I can only imagine the story she heard about, you know, I don't have this, or my software. Well, just build it yourself in assembler like I had to do back in the day.
That's right. You know?
Now, the real question is, did you have an actual assembler, or did you do it in, or did you punch the code into debug?
I punched into the debug. I didn't have an actual assembler.
Oh, my goodness.
So I had to refer to the opcodes and type in hex.
Oh, my aching brain.
Yeah. I also did that for 6502 and Apple. My first article was a hexadecimal converter for the Apple II, and I didn't have an actual assembler, so I looked through the 6502 manual and typed in the hex codes by hand. And I also only had 300 bytes, so I had to reuse some of the memory. So I was actually changing the code on the fly to fit everything in.
Okay, Todd, that explains a lot.
Todd was doing the equivalent of walking uphill both ways through a blizzard to get to school every day.
Yeah. Well, I did that too.
No, I wrote a couple of small printer control programs using debug on the PC, and it was just, I said, okay, I'm buying an assembler.
Oh. It does make things easier. I remember buying Merlin, the 6502 assembler from Apple II, after that first experience. I can't do this by hand anymore.
It's like using the toggle switches on a Altar or something.
Oh, then. I never did that, but I much admired the people who did.
Absolutely.
Eventually you moved from CompuServe to Microsoft Network, where I met you. I came on board at their May 1995 meeting, and I remember being overwhelmed by the number of people there, and of course by, you know, people like you whose names I had read but didn't actually know or never expected to meet. So
You're easily impressed. So
perhaps, but it was so. Did Microsoft steal you away for the Microsoft Network, or is there something you approach them about?
I knew a couple of people in Seattle that were not working for Microsoft that I had known me when I was working at CompuServe, and they acted as an intermediary because I felt like, quite frankly, that CompuServe was not understanding the sea change that was going on with the internet. And CompuServe was really an odd duck. They were wholly owned until they spun them off. They were wholly owned by H&R Block.
Right.
And they were controlled by the H&R Block board, who I would not imagine had a real good grasp of the space that CompuServe was in. I mean, they were people who ran a tax service. So I was, even though I had a lot of loyalty to CompuServe, I felt like the time had come to move on, that they weren't quite getting what was going on with the web.
Yeah.
And I was interested in doing something different anyway.
Yeah, you know, the for people who don't remember, and you just jogged my memory myself, is my recollection is... Oh, okay. I might maybe get a disagreement from somebody's dog.
Yeah, my dog okay, sees someone.
Yeah, something. So John's birds sometimes disagree with me when I'm speaking too, but they've been awfully quiet today.
They've been on mute for a lot of the conversation. They have been active. They've been responding. I'm just silencing.
Yeah, John's birds don't like me. I'm not sure why, but or at least they disagree with me. But in any case, my recollection is CompuServe started because H&R Block had spare cycles in their mainframes and wanted to make some money off it.
I'm trying to remember. I believe CompuServe originally started out as a time-sharing company.
Okay.
As a part of an insurance company. And they were selling spare time there. I could be wrong on that aspect of it.
That sounds right.
It's been so long. And then H&R Block bought them.
Oh, okay.
And it worked out so well because they were able to put connection points in all the local H&R offices. Mm-hmm. So they were able to build an actual network, even though it was a very expensive network back in those days.
Yeah, it's amazing how these things developed in the pre-internet days. And I should also note that, although we're coming up to the end of our cycle here, I'm gonna ask Don to return to talk more about shareware in general and Microsoft Network and then what followed that. But the Microsoft Network was not on the internet. It was called Project Marvel, if I remember correctly. And it was like AOL and like CompuServe. It was on a proprietary system that you dialed into. And it didn't shift to an internet-based service until several years later, after the famous talk that Charles Fitzgerald had with Bill Gates, saying, "You know, we need to get on this internet thing." But we were. It was, you had to get software from Microsoft and dial into a network, and
Well, it wasn't too hard to get that software since it was bundled with Windows 95.
Well, let's see. Yeah, Windows 95 hadn't actually launched yet, I think.
No, but once it had in 95, it was on the install disks or on the CD.
Yeah, that's true.
It was definitely on the CD. It might have been on the install disks, too.
Yeah, that's true. And for those who don't remember, when we were beta testing Windows 95, Don probably remembers this, I think we used to get, how many floppies was it? Was it like 40 floppies? 50? It was a lot of floppies.
Yeah, I don't have that on floppy anymore, but I was looking at Windows 3.1, and I think it's 7 or something outrageous like that.
Yeah, it is 7 for Windows 3.1. I actually built, for fun last summer, a retro virtual PC in VirtualBox that's running Windows 3.1 and DOS, and you know, I use it to play games occasionally. But yeah, 7 disks for Windows 3.1.
Yeah, so I guess it must have been 10 or 15 disks for Windows
3.1. So 95, yeah, 95's got to be some factor, you know, larger than that.
It might have been in the 20s, I think.
Yeah, but I just remember it was a lot. You know, you could get a wrist problem by doing the floppy changes, just installing them. And we would get those updates monthly, I think. I mean, I had a lot of, I don't know what happened to all those floppies, but they eventually shifted to sending them on CDs, which saved us a lot of time and effort. But it was quite a thing. In any case, we had a great chat with Don Watkins, who really kicked a lot of this online community stuff up off in 1982. Back when the PC was, PC came out in 81, so it was 1 year old, right? Kind of an amazing thing to think about, and I'm looking forward to speaking with Don more about the good old days and what we've morphed into. I have a whole bunch of questions that we didn't get to. But thanks, Don, for joining us. Hoping you join us again, and maybe in a couple of weeks or, you know, whenever you have time.
It's been a real pleasure. I've enjoyed it tremendously. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, and you know, we should, you know, I was just thinking, we actually missed an anniversary for MSN last year, but we should see if any of the old MSNers are on and maybe get together with John and talk about MSN at some point too, because that was some wild and woolly days. And you know, now that there's been enough years between separating us, between the service and us, we can probably disclose a lot of the stuff we ran into back then. Like having to write, if I remember correctly, we had to write raw SQL code to update our site sometimes.
Oh, goodness. Well, that, and you have to have me back, because I've got to tell you the story about GIF.
Oh.
As a teaser, I've got the most hilarious story about GIF you've ever heard in your life.
Okay.
That you've never heard.
Okay. We will have you back for that. And also, you know, I've always pronounced it GIF, but I understand the founder of the graphics protocol calls it GIF too. So you are apparently
it is GIF.
On
yeah.
the I, right
I,
side
I am
of
telling you, it's like the peanut butter.
Okay, so we will have Don back to talk about GIF, which I've been mispronouncing for, I don't know, 25 years now. But I did hear it was called GIF, and I still pronounce it wrong. It's just one of those things, you know. I also pronounce my last name incorrectly, so that's all right. There is no hard R
in Japanese. And most people mispronounce your last name.
Well, this is true. But, you know, there is no hard R in Japanese. So there's.
But it's more than three letters, so.
Well, they also mispronounce my first name, which is four letters.
That's when you know you're in a better class or friends.
Oh, Toad, I'm sorry for you so much.
In case, John Westfall and I had a good time talking to Don Watkins. We are definitely going to have him back, for nothing else, if for that GIF story. But definitely we want to talk about Microsoft Network and talk about shareware, more about shareware, where it's evolved, and also what Don thinks. And, you know, as we get closer to the IBM PC's actual anniversary, I think we want to return to the IBM PC and talk about what we've seen in the intervening 35 years. It's been a wild and woolly ride, and certainly it changed my life. You know, if you had asked me 35 years ago if I would be doing, you know, computer technology type work full time, I would say, no, you must be joking. I don't think so. And yet, here I am, and here we are, and we will talk to you all next time. Thanks for listening.